Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
In this episode of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Black, author of Forts and also Fortifications and Siegecraft, talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about the fortified palaces and manor houses of the 16th century.
It might seem surprising in the midst of an international crisis to consider, as it were, an aspect of one's relationship with the deep history of one's own country, but life goes on. And at the one hand, I've already discussed in this series the background to Ukraine and the background to the relationship between the Eastern Question and the Great Game. We've had three of those. They were all prescient, and they're all worth listening to again, if only for Graham's comments, not mine. But rather than repeat ourselves, what I decided to do was to talk about something from my experience. I mean, I have been to Ukraine, but from my experience in Britain. And I want to talk about staying in a castle, which is not something I have done, but I want to set it in the background of a small boy growing up in the suburbs of outer London and a childhood fascination with castles. I mean, I grew up in a 1930s house, which was as uncastellated as it could have been. But as a small child, I was very interested in them. I can recall, as a relatively small boy, my father helped making a papier-mâché model of a Motton Bailey and little soldiers being put outside. I can remember going down to the local library, which was so important for people of that generation, and in my view is still really crucial to the public culture of this country, and reading books like R.R. Selman on medieval warfare and taking an interest in them, and the novels of G.A. Henty. And then I think it's fair to say, you know, I travelled a little bit in England, I saw castles, I went in the late 60s with my father to Germany, and actually in Germany stayed in a castle. Most of the time we stayed in German bed and breakfast, but we actually splashed out one evening and stayed in a castle in the Rhineland, and it was quite extraordinary for me to see the views from it and to actually go up stone staircases, so very different to the life one was used to in suburbia. University took me in different directions, but I was appointed in Durham in 1980, and in Durham there is a Norman core to the city, and the history department, which was on the Bailey, a phrase resonant for those of you interested in castle architecture, abutted closely onto the castle, or what in Durham was University College, and I became a tutor there. So I had a post in the history department, lecturer, senior lecturer, reader, professor. But during that entire period, I also was a personal tutor in castle. And what that meant is you would have a certain number of chaps, and then eventually chaps and girls, who you were responsible for, discussing their life with them and reviewing their progress. And I would go there and eat. And I would eat in castle every single day I was in Durham, which was about 4 days a week, sometimes 5 days a week. And it was absolutely tremendous to sit in a Norman castle on a raised dais. The food was terrible, but, you know, given the modest amount of money that existed, it was 50p was the budget per meal. And we ate the same food as the students, though we paid more for it, I'm glad to say. But the setting was wonderful. In fact, one of the odd things was going down to Oxbridge every so often and thinking one was slumming it in terms of where one ended up, because obviously they didn't have the equivalent of a castle, looking out over a Norman cathedral as well. And then I moved to Exeter, and Exeter has many strengths, a beautiful campus, and indeed there is the remains of two castles in Exeter, one in not bad nick, one in terrible nick, but the university was nothing to do with either. And so it was considerably interest to me to discover that there was actually a castle one could stay in within 100 miles of where I live. I hadn't known that. And it was only serendipity, the joined the Relay and Chateau chain, and I saw some details about that. And I decided I would treat myself and go and stay in Thornbury Castle. Now, Thornbury is particularly interesting from my perspective because I also wrote a book on England in the age of Shakespeare. And the Duke of Buckingham, who is executed under Henry VIII, executed in 1521, was the man who really developed the castle. It's the last major example of a castle palace or palace castle, depending upon your point of view, in English history. In other words, it's essentially a new development. There had been a manor house there, and it was developed as a major site by the Duke, but also as a fortified site, whereas, of course, most of the great homes that are built anew in the 16th century in England, the characteristic feature of them is that they are not castles. I mean, they famously have lots of glass, like Hardwick Hall, for example, and the last thing you would think of doing is defending them. So it was very interesting to go to a house which was never completed because the Duke was executed before it could be completed, but where a lot of the features of the castle survive. Now, what essentially happened to him, and people who are interested in Shakespeare will remember that his father also got beheaded, and his father also got beheaded for falling out with a king, in this case, Richard III. Buckingham plays a very major role in the play of Richard III in helping Richard seize power in 1483 from his nephew, Edward V, who becomes the older of the two princes in the Tower. Then he falls out with Richard. He rises in rebellion. The River Severn is in spate, so he's unable to get his Welsh tenants to come over, and he is defeated and executed. In the case of his son, he is often referred to as the wealthiest aristocrat in the country. He was certainly Duke of Buckingham, Earl of Stafford, Earl of Hereford, and Earl, I think it's of Northamptonshire. He had, as a descendant of Edward III, a sort of somebody who was able to at least worry the Tudors, and that was rather a precarious position. Indeed, I was rather amused to see that I was on a staircase in which there were three bedrooms. I'm not sure whether deliberately or not, I imagine it was deliberately, they were each named after somebody that had been beheaded at the behest of a Tudor monarch. So there was the Countess of Salisbury, who's a Courtney, again, descendant of Edward III. There was Catherine Howard, and there was Lady Jane Grey. I found myself in a bedroom named after Lady Jane Grey, which I have to say, for a historian, is quite amusing, or I found it quite amusing. One must be allowed one's little humour. And I arranged for myself to be shown round the castle, which was fascinating. What they've done is they've converted rooms into bedrooms, and they've also got a Tudor hall, which they've converted into a function room, and they've converted the base of one of the towers into a dining room. So it was very interesting for me to sit and have dinner and look out through the defensive features and to arrive early enough to walk round the site and actually evaluate what it would have been like both to attack it, if that was what one wished to do, and to defend it. So you can see the machicolations at the top of the towers through which you could have poured hot water or boiling oil or whatever you wanted to, or just shot down. And those, you know, may or may not be aware in my publications. I have published two books on castles, one called Fortifications and Siegecraft and one called Forts. So it was really interesting to see one that is there. From my point of view, it's an odd experience because I've not been one of these historians that thinks, oh, well, you know, you need to go to a site and, as it were, have a memory triggered by it, in sort of Edward Gibbon and the Roman Forum in 1764. I don't in any way criticise those. And I think Gibbon's writing about the inspiration he received there is rather marvellous. But I think with many modern historians, there's a slightly bogus element to it, particularly because they usually are actually dependent on their book being published on the work they do, which takes place over a period of time, and then moulding that to suit what publishers and their readers may want. And the actual inspiration of place, which may be crucial for a poet or crucial for a novelist, is not generally the same for a historian. But nevertheless, having said that, I did find it fascinating to be in the castle. I also found it very interesting to consider its site. Nearby is the settlement of Aust, A-U-S-T, which is where the old ferry used to cross into southern Wales before the Severn Bridge was constructed. And you could actually see Thornbury as a defensive site that controlled access to southern Wales and from southern Wales. And you can see Henry VIII's concern, and allegedly Buckingham had talked about what the situation would be if Henry died. And of course, this was germane because at this point, Henry, who's married, of course, to Catherine of Aragon, has a daughter, Mary, later Mary I. He has no son. There is a lot of uncertainty as to whether English politics would accept a female ruler. The only one previously to ascend to the throne, Henry I's daughter, Matilda, in 1135, had triggered a civil war, and her relative, Stephen, had instead become the king. And although there was to be a whole series of female rulers coming up, Mary I, Elizabeth II, Mary II as a co-ruler, and Queen Anne, and then obviously more recently, first Victoria, and then Elizabeth II. It was by no means the case at the beginning of the 1520s that people could feel secure in it. So there was a political strategy here. Buckingham was building what was a palace that would be the centre for his affinity of aristocrats looking to him as a power broker, and also enabling him to, as it were, project himself onto the stage in England, still a young, relatively young man. But also there is a defensive site that controls the access to Wales. And the access to Wales had proved important in the coup of 1399, which had led to Henry IV overcoming Richard II, the last of the Plantagenets, and again had been the basis for the power of Henry VII. So I think it's worth drawing attention to this as a last stage of the pre-Reformation instability in England. As recently as 1497, there had been a major rising in the west of England, in the Cornishmen, which had led to a Cornish army getting as far as Blackheath near London before it was dispersed. And there is this sense of precariousness prior to the Reformation, of the afterhang of the Wars of the Roses. And there is not this clear sense of periodization that at 1485 with Bosworth, the Middle Ages ends. And one of the attractions, one of the fascinations of staying at Thornbury is you've got a sense of the Middle Ages. And there's one last echo of that, because I'm sure Graham has some important observations, but one last echo is a simple matter. The house was seized by Henry VIII, what a surprise, And he actually stayed there, and it became, as it were, briefly a kind of royal residence and an additional royal palace, as it were, rather as Cardinal's College in Oxford becomes Christ Church again, under again as a result of a fallen Tudor favourite of Henry VIII's. Henry stays there. In fact, he stays there with Anne Boleyn, a stay that is made longer than anticipated, 10 days instead of 2 days, because there's plague in Bristol, and plague is serious, not like COVID. A lot of people will die from it, and it's highly infectious. But thereafter, the castle had fallen into some decay. It was sold. It went through branches of the Howard family. Buckingham's son-in-law was Thomas, Duke of Norfolk, the leading Howard, who of course had fallen out expeditiously with his father-in-law in order to save his position around the king. The Howards held on to it, but it was not a Howard residence of any significance, and obviously bits and pieces of it were used to other purposes. But then what was interesting to me is that in the mid-19th century, a Howard bought it, I think it's 1858, and to a certain extent does bits of it up. So that you've got two histories there. You've got the Tudor history, but you've also got a sort of post-Waverley, Sir Walter Scott, Ivanhoe, English medievalism, which is itself rather fascinating, because at the same time as English society, British society, I should say, is the wonder of modernity with the Great Exhibition of 1851, with legislation trying to introduce a modern state with a country which is urbanizing, you have got this profound interest in medievalism starting in the 18-teens, but very strong also in the 1840s and 50s. You can see it in things like the Oxford movement. You can see it in things like Disraeli's novels and Disraeli's Young England movement and the importance of that for conservatism. You can see it in Puginesque forms of architecture, and including the building, rebuilding, I suppose, of the Houses of Parliament. So what you've actually got in Thornbury is two, as it were, sections of English stroke British history. And I think that makes it particularly interesting for those who are thoughtful of and perceptive about the past.
Well, Professor Black, I want to start with looking at Thornbury Castle and trying to work out whether it's a fusion between the sort of manor houses that are built in the Tudor period, in the Stuart period, and the castles of the Middle Ages that preceded that period. Would you describe it as a fusion of the two, or is it distinctively one or the other, but with some hints of
that's very good. No, I would say it's a fusion in the sense of a castle palace. It's certainly of a scale much greater than a manor house. A wealthy duke in this period, there are not very many dukes. In fact, thanks to Tudor monarchs, I mean, you can think of the Duke of Norfolk, for example, coming to an end under Elizabeth I. Thanks to Tudor monarchs, the rank of Duke, as it were, dies out. It gets revived later. And of course, again, you think about it, a Duke of Buckingham, though again, this chap gets murdered. But no, this is a palace. And it included palatial style apartments for the Duke on the first floor, which gave him more views, for the Duchess on the ground floor. And there are different sizes of windows to indicate the greater rank of the Duke. And there was also a gallery built so that the Duke could take the air from his, as it were, apartments. And then the gallery went round a wall and then linked up to the church so that the Duke could go to the chapel. without having to mix with ordinary people. And indeed, one of the charges against him was that he was having the manifestations of royalty. And I think it's fair to say that that is reflected in the scale of what he was building. But as you correctly say, there are elements of the kind of palace castle of the medieval period, of which I would say the two biggest examples that we have are Alnwick for the Dukes of Northumberland and Arundel for the Dukes of Norfolk. Now, each of those is a medieval structure, so it's earlier than Thornbury. I mean, they're not hotels, you can't stay there unless you're chum of the owner, although you can visit both as paying visitors, you know, go in, and actually they're both worth visiting. The paintings on display at Alnwick are particularly interesting. But there is a sort of, I would say, almost gloominess as you go further back into the medieval period. One of the interesting things about the 16th century is that they are better with windows and glass. I think that that is so that they are more spacious in the sense that they create a sense of space and light. Now, there are defensive features for this castle. There is a big gatehouse, there are surrounding walls. It's exciting. I mean, I sort of was trying to work this one out, looking out from it. What I would say is, in the event of the Severn having a really bad flood, and we've seen that, you know, we've got one at the moment in the mid-Severn, we've seen it before, the river would clearly burst its banks nearby, but Thornbury is on a rise sufficiently to ensure it wouldn't get flooded. So I would say it's well situated from that point of view. It's not sitting on a volcanic plug. So it's not like, for example, Edinburgh Castle or Hadrian's Wall on the eastern end, which are on volcanic features, which enable them to take much greater weight. But from what I could see, there is no sign that I could see of any cracks in the structure. So from what I could see, it was appropriate for its underlying geology. And it struck me as being rather like the Tower of London. As you probably know, the Tower of London is where a gravel bed approaches the river, so that there's actually more weight for the sort of more underpinning for the weight of the structure than rather than it just being on alluvial sand. And from what I could see, I would say the same thing is true of Thornbury. And again, I mean, you know, people will go and stay and visit a place. And in fact, you don't actually need to stay there in order to visit it. You can go and be a paying guest for tea, and you can be a paying guest for a meal. And I had a dinner there and it was excellent, but there's no indication. Well, in fact, I asked, you don't have to stay to have the dinner. But if for those people who are interested in, you know, fortresses, I think there's a lot there to observe and to think about. And as you correctly say, this transition between the medieval period and the Tudors. And of course, there is this great problem that history is organized by so many of us, including sometimes myself, I have to hold up my hand, in terms of building blocks that are chronological. But not only are those building blocks largely determined in hindsight, but also linked to that, but also separate, people's life experience is not determined by an age. I mean, most of my life was lived in the 20th century, but here I am in the third decade of the 21st century. I think you will have had exactly the same issue at Thornbury. I mean, obviously, average life expectancy was different, but when the Duke was executed in 1521, the majority of the people thereabouts were 15th century people who will either have directly experienced the Wars of the Roses, which at battle scale went on beyond Bosworth. There was a very big battle, for example, at Stoke in 1487, in which a Yorkist army under the Earl of Lincoln was defeated. So battles, you know, people would have been aware of the battles. They would also have been aware of their parents talking about battle and war, and their grandparents, if they were from a military background, might well have served in the latter campaigns of the Hundred Years' War against France, of which the last battle was 1453, but Edward VII, Henry VII, and Henry VIII all campaigned in France, and indeed there were also campaigns in Scotland. So it is a very militarized society. I mean, you're Scottish, Graham, as you will know. 8 years before Buckingham's execution, you see the so-called Flower of Scotland laid low at the Battle of Flodden. The idea that in some way, and indeed if you're looking at domestic Scottish politics, run on and into the mid 16th century fighting, run on into the 1560s and the little war that sees the end of Mary Queen of Scots' reign, the idea that in some way England, Britain, Ireland, Wales have become peaceful because we have ended the Middle Ages is a joke. Also, the idea that gunpowder, by bringing down castle walls, has ended the Middle Ages and major aristocrats is very questionable. I mean, I've discussed this at length in my works. You've only got to look at French history in the late 16th century, and you see in the French Wars of Religion, powerful aristocrats like Condé or Guise or Montmorency, who are acting as if they're not aware that the script sheet says, you know, right chaps, overmighty subjects are out. So I think one, and there is the argument, I mean, it's a contentious argument, but there is the argument that the early stages of the English Civil War, in part, sees a aristocratic rising, people like the Earl of Essex, the Earl of Manchester, Lord Sandseal, against the crown. I think that would be possibly pushing it too far, but what certainly the fighting of the early 1640s showed is how important aristocrats were in order for the raising of forces. And that was true not just of the royalists, but also of the parliamentarians. And interestingly enough, that goes on. I mean, I was very struck when I did some archival research for a book on 1783 to 93 to see that the government in 1792, when they feared a radical uprising of supporters and sympathizers with the French Revolution, turned to Lord Lieutenants and other aristocrats, people like Viscount Townshend, urging them not just to, as it were, call on the formal mechanisms of the equivalent of the militia, but also their tenants. And indeed, the same thing had happened in 1745 during the Jacobite Rising. Aristocrats had raised their own regiments in order to show their loyalty to George II. So I think one way to look at the castle is to say to yourself, both Thornbury, but more generally the issue of castles, is to say, yes, there were to be, by the 18th century, clear obsolescence with castles. You get the slighting of castles, the deliberate damaging of castles, so they shouldn't have military capability, which you see with the successful parliamentary forces in the civil wars. You then, in the 18th century, have the cult of the ruin, and painters like Richard Wilson and his painting of Okehampton Castle depict these rather, you know, sort of sort of gothicized and rather attractive backdrops. But that is not a description of the situation in the 16th century. And as late as 1745, 46, I quoted in one of my books, my book on Culloden, a letter from Lord Glenorchy to his daughter, regretting that he in fact had changed the well-fortified nature of the house he had inherited for the latest modern architecture, which made it less defendable. Now, by the late 18th century, castellated features on, for example, gatehouses or walls round estates are fundamentally to keep poachers out and to establish the limit of the domain, as it were, of the lord in a particular area, rather than as defensive features. And you can see this in houses which still have some castellation. Uggbrook, for example, where the grounds are done up by Capability Brown. Nobody would have thought of defending that. And of course, the ha-ha, you know, the sort of ditch which is separates the immediate garden from the wider estate, is essentially to keep sheep and cattle out of the garden, not for defensive purposes. But all of that is looking to the late 18th century, not to the period of Thornbury in the 16th, or indeed, I would say, as late as the early 17th. We then, for the 19th century, have the fascination that people are either repairing, and Thornbury is an example, Sir William Armstrong's work at Bamborough Castle is another example, the work at Alnwick is an example, George III's work at Windsor Castle is an example. They are repairing castles then, or even building ones which have in part castellated features, Cragside in Northumberland is an example, but without any defensive intention. And I think the way, if one looks at the interrelationship between building purpose, building style, and historical context, one has a fascinating way of looking at the country's history. Now, ironically, today, although people don't tend to think in terms of fortification, many residences are fortified with burglar alarms, with, you know, window locks, with more than one lock or key to get into the house. Many shops, police stations, banks are fortified with toughened glass or other security devices. We are more fortified now than we would have been 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, 200 years ago, which may be a reflection of a declining confidence in policing. I don't know. Maybe people can consider that for themselves. But in the early 16th century, your basic defense, if you were somebody of social eminence, like your good self, Graham, would have been to have not just your fortification, but also your retainers round you. And if you're looking at a site like Thornbury or Alnwick or Arundel, what you've got is or Hampton Court, what you've got is a site that is big enough to have what in effect is your personal force of escorts, bodyguards, bother boys, whatever term you wish to use, but which again creates political concern. In fact, it's very interesting. The very first outbreak of violence on a major scale in the French Wars of Religion was in 1562 at Vassy, when the Duke of Guise's clientele, and the Duke of Guise was the leading Catholic noble in the country, as it were, falls out with a Protestant congregation at church. Now, I think it's pretty clear that the Duke of Guise's bully boys were looking for a fight, but that was itself enough to cause a large-scale chaos and confusion. And I suppose with Henry VIII, We tend to think of Henry as very much in control of the agenda, but we need to be aware that in part that was a matter of playing off and neutering, if necessary, what appeared to be threats from prominent aristocrats. A relatively small group of men, we're talking about men, a group which disliked each other, a group that was to be riven as a result of the religious changes and also as a result of the different patronage possibilities created by his varied marriages. But in many senses, I think that, you know, there's obviously the fascination with Thomas Cromwell as a result of Hilary Mantel's rather lackluster novels, very big but terrible dialogue and really rather like watching paint dry. There's a lot much more interesting in Henry VIII's early years. So one has the Empson and Dudley affair, you have the anti-foreigner Evil May Day riots in London, you have the Battle of the Golden Spur in France and Henry VIII trundling into France, and you have, you know, Buckingham coming along, and then in the mid-1520s, you have large-scale disorder. There's a lot of interest there, and to a degree, it's been overshadowed by the fascination with the 1530s, which was, of course, the period that Geoffrey Elton, the great scholar, looked at. But in many senses, I think that that is a great pity, because the earlier period in his reign, I think, is of more consequence than people allow for.
I'd like to ask what aspects of the medieval castle, the fortified palaces and fortified manor houses of the Tudor period did away with?
Ah, well, that's again interesting. I mean, to many respects, what you're looking at in the early, very early Tudor works are a continuation of the medieval period. Where you've got change is the so-called artillery fortresses that Henry VIII builds along the south coast, essentially as a result of the Franco-Austrian, or Habsburg, I think would be fairer term, rapprochement of 1538, and the anxiety that these two Catholic powers will attack England. And there is a series of fortifications built, and I, you know, reproduce plans from them in my book on forts. And these are ones that are designed for carrying artillery pieces to overawe anchorages that would be used for invasions. I think it's fair to say that although primitive cannon start quite early, and although in some late medieval castles you can see features that reflect the possibilities of cannon, I think it's fair to say that the major redesign that you are to get comes from the 1530s onwards. Again, if you're interested in it from the Scottish perspective, the greatest example of that, probably in terms of the scale of an individual site in the British Isles, is Berwick-upon-Tweed, where the walls are changed in order to, you know, obviously provide it as a defensive site against a French-backed Scottish invasion, and very much from the point of view of an artillery fortress. But that comes from the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, later in the 16th century. So again, we've got a process of transition, continuity, variation, rather than this kind of rather flawed idea of a military revolution, which is so often provided, and which has a lot, again, I've written quite extensively on that in my works on 16th century warfare. I would say that you have change in continuity as well as continuity in change. In other words, continuity in change has always been a feature. There has never been a standard medieval castle which has been unchanging. But equally, the notion about the combination of defensive strength and firepower potential, as well as a hindrance to the assailant, are the mix that you see throughout the period, but with different manifestations on specific sites.
Mm-hmm. And these both changes and continuities, they're in England and Scotland roughly in step with similar changes and continuities in Western Europe. Or do we see something very distinctive in the British Isles?
Oh, that's really interesting. Okay. It used to be argued, and I think the classic instances here are Michael Roberts and Geoffrey Parker, that there was a kind of model of a military revolution of changes and which diffused across Europe. And so, in other words, a kind of a paradigm which was then spread. I think it's fair to say that that account is now, to put it mildly, challenged. I think it's fair to say that you see different military trajectories. The most obvious different ones are in Eastern Europe, and there's more than one in Eastern Europe. But as Philip showed in his very interesting work on the Anglo-Scots Wars of the early 16th century and on other works, there were also distinctive features about developments in the British Isles. And indeed, I once had a doctoral student who I'm glad to say completed and an excellent doctorate called James Raymond, who took the same sort of approach and showed, again, distinctive features about British development. So you shouldn't assume that there's only one paradigm. And again, one can take this further. I'm currently doing some work on the history of cavalry. And it's the kind of emphasis on, this is very crude here, but the kind of emphasis on heavy cavalry you might get if your perspective is from France needs to be qualified by drawing attention to a light cavalry, which is more prevalent in the more arid regions of Iberia. You do have heavy cavalry units there, but there's more light cavalry. And again, much more so in parts of Eastern Europe, such as Poland and Hungary. So I think one's got to be wary of the idea that there is a single unitary European model. Europe looks different in the 16th century, if your perspective is Munich or Mannheim or Milan or Madrid or Malmo or Moscow or whatever M you want for the British Isles. We could say Manchester, but let's be interesting and say Matlock. And I think the same thing would be true in all of our periods. I mean, one of the great problems, and you know, here we can be contentious and come up to the present day. One of the great problems in much of the debate about Europe in the last few years in Britain has been the assumption that there is a European trajectory, consciousness, state of affairs defined by the European Union, and therefore that Britain, as it were, if it left, as indeed it did eventually leave the European Union in 2020, that represented a moving away from this unitary model. Well, I think the point is that that unitary model itself doesn't describe the variations within the European Union at the present day in political culture, society, economics, let alone in the broader Europe. And we're talking in the perspective at the present moment of a crisis in Ukraine. It is worth bearing in mind, and it is a sad reflection on the heat generated by the issue of leaving the European Union within Britain, it is worth bearing in mind that many people who were most angry about us leaving the European Union seem totally oblivious about a European civilization, country, society, however you wish to define Ukraine, being invaded at the present moment.
Well, on that topical note, we must leave the discussion of life in the castle. But thank you very much indeed, Jeremy Black.
Well, thank you. As I said, I would urge people to go and look at Thornbury, whether they stay or not. I mean, I had a wonderful stay. But even if you just go and have a meal, it is fascinating. It is really interesting to visit, stay in a castle that is open to the public.
Well, that's your Englishman's Home for now. Professor Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.